This is Livewell Talk on Advancements in Cardiology. I'm Dr. Dustin Arnold, Chief Medical Officer at Union Point Health, St. Luke's Hospital. St. Luke's has been caring for hearts in the Sea Rapids community for over 45 years. During that time, many historica first have occurred, as well as countless advancements in cardiac care. Joining me to discuss the advancements in cardiac care are two of the cardiologists with St. Luke's Heart Care Clinic, Dr. Fahid Eldrazi and Dr. Tala Farid. Dr. Eldrazi, welcome back. Dr. Farid, welcome to your first podcast.
That's correct. Thank you very much.
Welcome both of you.
Thanks.
As an electrophysiologist, Dr. Farid, just tell me what's on the horizon for electrophysiology. I think a lot has come out in the last year. It's like a new iPhone. Like, it just comes out, it gets updates all the time. But just kind of tell us what's come out in the last couple of years and what do you see in the future?
Yeah, so electrophysiology is one of the most developing field in cardiology. There's a lot happening, and there's a lot that has happened last couple of years, and there's a lot which is on the horizon that's going to happen next couple of years. So we broadly divide electrophysiology in ablation procedures and the devices, when the implants, the pacemaker, and the defibrillator. So the first part where we talk about ablations, putting catheters in to treat heart arrhythmias, atrial fibrillation has becoming a very exciting field. First of all, it's a very common arrhythmia and prevalence is increasing. So we are there are new technologies coming in for treatment of this these arrhythmias. And the most exciting one now, we are looking at what we call pulse field ablation. So this is right now the biggest concern that we have ablation is the safety of ablation. There's a risk of perforation of the heart or perforation of the other structures. That risk is small, but it's serious and can be life-threatening. What PFA does, it significantly reduces the risk of adverse effects of the ablation and makes ablation much more efficient. So it ablates the tissue and it's cardiac selective. So you get all the benefits of ablation, but it does not affect any of the structure around it. So it doesn't affect esophagus, it doesn't affect the nerve. So essentially the safety becomes, the adverse effect essentially is zero of external extracardiac tissue involvement. Secondly, it makes the procedure very efficient. So the ablation of the nerve, which can take, of the vein, which can take anywhere from 20 minutes to 30 minutes, that time has reduced to seconds. The pulse field delivery is actually milliseconds. And you press a button and it's a blade and go to the next one and press a button. So we are hoping that we're gonna have that technology in mid this year. And St. Luke's is actually at the forefront and we already had meetings and looking forward to getting this technology in very near future. Secondly, one procedure that we started doing and very excited about is ablation of other heart conditions, which we didn't have good options for. And one is vasovagal syncope. It's very common, especially in the younger population.
Yeah.
Their heart rates drop and right. The blood vessels dilate, and we never had good options. But now what we can do is we actually go into the heart and figure out where the innervations are and ablate the nerve ending so they increase the heart rate. And we have already done several now with excellent results. And then in pacemaker world, there's a lot coming, and the biggest technology that we're looking forward to is the leadless pacemaker for dual chamber for both atrium and the ventricle.
Now, that first of all, that one's fascinating.
Yeah.
In my previous career, where I practiced previously, I put in singles for just sick sinus syndrome in older patients. And the fact that they have a lead, that just blows my mind. But is that all Bluetooth technology?
It is. It's a variant of Bluetooth, but it's proprietary because the safety is the biggest concern. They
sure.
don't want anybody to be able to go and hack. So that's the certain part of that they are saying it's Bluetooth related, but certain part is proprietary. But there are two units essentially, one in the atrium, one in the ventricle. They both communicate. And you can essentially, for the sick sinus syndrome, just like we used to do single leads, you can just do a single device in the upper chamber without anything in the ventricle.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
What I'm going to come back to you as well on this question here. Where, how do you think AI, artificial intelligence, will weave its way into the world of cardiology? What do you see happening there?
The biggest area, it's actually affecting a lot of fields.
Yeah.
The biggest area is actually the diagnostics, yeah. Where the echo, and I think the imaging, where it's going to have the biggest impact. And I think Dr. Eldrazi would be in better position.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Yep. So imaging specifically is, I mean, a lot of things have been moving into the AI project, though you cannot take the human equation out of that. But a lot of stuff are going to be automated, so at least for screening. And then the human factor comes after that, whether it's a scan. So if we're talking about the heart, we're talking about scan of the heart, MRI of the heart, echo, where basically AI will start identifying structures or abnormalities that we have to teach it to do. I came up with an idea a few years ago. I haven't had a chance to implement it. But one of that idea is basically to identify structures in the heart that are abnormal by artificial intelligence. And it's basically you're teaching a software how to identify abnormalities. And then you have to confirm it as a person. I don't believe we should rely totally on AI to tell us what's right and what's wrong. But it's going to speed up the process of reading, this process of interpreting and then not missing. Or at least if the AI identifies something, you don't agree with it, that's fine, but at least you're not going to miss it.
Right.
So it's going to be more sensitive, maybe not as specific, but it's going to be sensitive to not to miss stuff. And then in CT scan, that becomes very helpful too, whether CT of the lung, CT of the other structures, including CT of the heart. So
yeah, I think radiology, diagnostics, probably a better descriptor, is one of those fields that will have AI will have a significant influence.
Yeah.
The other one I've always thought, dermatology.
Pattern recognition.
You know, recognizing histopathology saying, well, this is normal, this is abnormal.
Yep. I mean, the same way you teach human beings, residents, and
fellows
to say this is a benign mole versus not, it's called pattern recognition. We used to do it as students.
Right, yeah.
That's how they taught us dermatology. But that's now you're doing it on a machine. Yeah. And then you're
a pathologist is looking at histology with 25, 30 years experience, right?
Yeah.
Well, now you're doing, you know, thousands of years of experience in seconds.
It still has to be very well taught.
Yes.
Beforehand and then, of course, checked. So there's still a way to go, but it's happening. Like whatever I thought about a few years ago, I can see people starting to publish about. So, yeah.
I think a lot will change in the coming years.
Yeah.
But it kind of goes, you know, I made the joke about the kind of the new iPhone in cardiology. You know, gastroenterology was this way maybe 10, 15 years ago with ERCP and diagnostic ultrasound. You really had this explosion in technology. And they even have some AI with colonoscopies, et cetera. But it, certainly cardiology's had a big blossom just in the last couple of years.
I mean, it's a big field and a lot of subspecialties, a lot of diseases. So there's always a room for something. The basics remains the same. I mean, the clinician, the basic information, but definitely technology. I mean, there's a lot of room and everything. I mean, even right now, I mean, there is a German company working on really addressing imaging from a different perspective, where you're basically looking at the heart inside the heart. So, I mean, I don't know if you've known these video games where basically you have like this kind of mask and you're in the game as if you're like inside the game. I actually tried that in 2019. It's still not out, but it's amazing. I mean, basically you take some pictures, but after that you're literally inside the heart looking at the different structures of the heart from the inside. They're still progressing this, but yeah, that's coming too. It's crazy. I mean, if I show you pictures of it on my phone, you'd be like, okay, that's crazy.
Well, just, I mean, like, you know, have either of you been to the Space Museum in Washington, D.C.?
Yes. Not Washington. Yes. I've been to different ones, but not Washington.
But you see what they went to the moon
with,
and you're like, I have more computer powering, 10 times more in my phone than they had. Right. You know, that is just, it is amazing, truly is. What do you think the biggest advancements in cardiology that you see coming?
I mean, there's a lot of things that happen, but coming is a lot of work on valvular disease from in my field. I'm going to leave the physiology part to you. So structural heart disease is still evolving, and there are a lot of procedures that are being fine-tuned. Right now, we've mastered TAVR, we've mastered CLIP, WATCHMAN, stuff like that. But there's still a lot of work that needs to be done on the mitral valve, specifically mitral stenosis and tricuspid valve. Because if the patient doesn't get surgical treatment of those, there's not much of an option if they are calcified mitral stenosis, non-rheumatic mitral stenosis, or if they have bad leaky tricuspid valve, not candidate for surgery. So a lot of work has been done in this respect. And right now, we're going to be mastering probably in the coming less than 5 years, my TriClip for the tricuspid valve.
And now, you know, I always thought that I would see valvular disease drop off significantly in my career just because there'd be less non-rheumatic. No, it hasn't at all, really.
And it's age-related.
Right.
Because our population is growing. So a lot of the disease is happening because of degeneration, we call it, wear and tear.
Yeah.
So you're going to expect to see a lot of that. Yeah, we're not seeing rheumatic heart disease.
No. And so I always thought, you know, as
we're seeing the advent of
antibiotics, that you'd see that drift away, but you really haven't.
Yeah, you'll see degenerative, calcified diseases, secondary from endocarditis, secondary from pulmonary hypertension, stuff like that. So, and if there's not candidate for surgery, then the only other option is procedures. And still, we haven't mastered the tricuspid valve and the mitral valve completely, except for CLIP. So, I mean, we have done some here. There has been a lot of research on, for example, putting like a TAVR valve in a mitral position. We call it valve and mag, or even doing valve and valve. Those are something that has been done. We've done a couple, but this is very specific. You have to really like pick up the population that can get this procedure. And a lot of work has been done on this. I think in the coming 5-10 years, this is going to basically fly. Yeah.
What about I know you're not surgeons, either one of you, from a bypass standpoint. But what advances do you think are coming down the road there?
So a lot happened. I don't know if the surgeons can speak up better, but at least I can tell you that open heart surgery has changed. It's not about just doing a sternotomy and opening the chest wide open. So a lot of single disease. So for example, if you're fixing the valve, mitral valve repair, we can do it with minimal invasive approach, means a lateral incision instead of open heart, like completely cracking the chest open. It's better for the future because if you fix a valve like this and in the future the patient needs surgery, then you're not worried about entering the chest twice with a sternotomy.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So minimal invasive surgery, whether it's for the aortic valve or mitral valve or for cardiac masses, is already on the fly. Some other institutions are doing robotic repair, robotic resections of masses in the heart. Those are also less invasive than sternotomy. So these are things that need to be done in like high volume places. Surgeons need to be trained for that also.
Right.
So, yeah.
Speaking of cardiac masses, is cardiac oncology, is that growing?
Yes, it's now a subspecialty.
Really?
People can do like a special year of training in that. Now, whether they combine it with something else to fill the whole year, it's in progress. But cardio-oncology is a different animal right now. I mean, with all the immunotherapy, with the immunomodulators, there's tons of medications now.
Right. Oncology yes.
From the time I graduated till now, I don't even recognize the categories anymore. Mm-hmm. So, and all of them can cause hypertension, pericardial effusion, cardiomyopathy. So, this is a different specialty right now. And then how you protect the heart, how you monitor the heart, I mean, I'm not a specialist in that, but at least I can tell you a lot of work, a lot of homework. I mean, I do every time I see somebody with these medications, try to learn about, okay, what is this medication? What does it do? Now, if we have a PharmD with us that knows these things, they can make our life easier. But a lot of monitoring needs to be done. Like prostate, for example, cancer, there's a lot of new medications that affect the heart, and then you really have to know them by now.
As medical director of the infusion center, I probably spend about 6 hours a month just reading about new medications there.
There's a lot of them. And, so, I mean, we're learning on the go. I mean, in practice, you learn how to evolve yourself to keep up to speed on what's going on. But yeah, definitely there's cardio-oncology specialty
right now. Yeah, you have to work at it.
And we were actually looking for one in our group. They will be combined general and oncology. So yeah, that's an option, definitely.
What do you see as far as the consequences or of either COVID vaccines or COVID infection, the myocarditis? I know you and I had some cases we had together.
We talked about it even last time.
Has that dropped off?
I think it has come down. There was a year or two where we saw a lot of arrhythmias, and we were discussing among each other. It was like, I mean, you see PVCs, you see VTAC, I mean, but not that much.
Right.
So we had to figure out, I mean, what happened? It was COVID, I mean, and the vaccine. So which one had the most impact on that? I mean, who knows? I mean, most likely it was the virus causing more impact than the vaccine on the heart. But definitely, I mean, I'm not seeing much pericarditis with COVID. I mean, probably it's been a year since I've seen one myself. But the arrhythmias, I mean, we do the MRI and we see scars. I mean, we do cardiac MRI when, like in young people, and we see scarring, either from COVID or from the vaccine. Now, the thing is, I mean, they end up being low-risk situations. I mean, you can speak better about it. But yeah, I'm starting to see a slowdown in this. It's not as bad as it was. I mean, at some point, we were like, oh my gosh, I'm seeing like 3-4 in a week. I mean, that was too much. So right now, I think the incidence has come down, probably because COVID also is not as crazy bad as it was at the first 2 years.
Right, it's really dropped off. You know, one thing I think listeners, we have to cover is, can I use a microwave if I have a pacemaker?
Yeah, I mean, this is a question that everybody asks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, The Simpsons, we figured out that it was Sideshow Bob that did the crime, not Krusty, because the pacemaker in the microwave. So, I mean, this is a legitimate question.
That's absolutely right. No, it's a fair question. There's no concern about using microwave. But phone is a different thing, because last couple of years, they have incorporated stronger magnets in the phone. So especially with the defibrillator, and if it's on the left side, if you put a strong magnet on the same side, it's going to disable your ICD. So if your heart goes out of rhythm, you're not going to get shocked. So I tell patients that don't try not to put your phones in your upper left pocket next to your devices. But microwave is not a concern.
Not a concern.
Yeah. I tell them 1 feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, just like that.
I had a patient that had the, when I was at my VA clinic when I was a resident, so this is the early 90s, right? They had the old defibrillator that was on the outside of the heart, you know, and the box was in his stomach.
Right.
He said it went off once, and he was turkey hunting, and he thought somebody shot him. You know, he thought for sure somebody shot him. But that's the only time it went off. But that was an impressive looking device.
Yes. I mean, things have changed. The last, we had a patient who kept saying that his device keep making noise and buzzing, and we could not figure out.
Actually, I know about this one.
And then we found out that he had glasses with the magnets on, and he would, you know, that would separate and would just hang here right on his device.
Oh my gosh.
And he would have alerts from the device saying there's magnet on it, it's disabled. So finally we figured out.
That is interesting.
Yeah. Speaking of, I mean, like, it's amazing how much imaging and ultrasound and everything has changed. I mean, like, literally all what we had 20 years ago is M mode. for ultrasound, and everybody was like so excited about it. Like, if I want to read right now an echo that was done 20 years ago, I probably wouldn't know, because the quality was like, I don't know, it's like different, the color, the mapping, the everything. I mean, right now, I mean, we rely on 3D a lot. For structural heart disease, we rely on 3D for interventions. When we're doing Watchmen, when we're doing CLIP.
Well,
and 3D is like literally like you're seeing the heart like the way, I mean, if you don't know how to read 2D, hey, guess what? This is 3D. You'll read it. Yeah, that's, everybody will read it. Like,
you know, we used to be like specialists in echoes. We used to read the echoes on VHS tapes. You know, and you had to fast forward through them and rewind them. And
I don't think I've seen one.
Yeah, that's we used to read those on there. And, you know, now it's all digital. It's just, it's not even a comparison.
Like, yeah,
a
lot the quality has changed. Like, even from my fellowship years till now, the quality has changed. Like from X6, X7, or X8, for example, with a TE, that's a big change. Like, the quality like became like crystal clear. Literally like a big, big change. And then they keep adding stuff that makes things more appealing.
So, do you remember when, this is kind of in the weeds here, but I think when they went to higher slice CT scans, and you had, and I mean, it was growth for radiology too, right? So you had this kind of era where you had all these incidental nodules that, you know, the radiologists were seeing for the first time, right?
Yep. Because it was, what to do about
it. Right, you know, now you don't see it as much because they know about them and they, you know.
I remember a family member like this.
Yeah.
Even back in Lebanon when I was a student, and everybody freaked out.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what to do? And then they said, okay, well, there's no clinical condition here. Just do it another year, just like that.
Yeah.
And then it turned out to be the right thing to do.
Right. Yeah, that, I mean, I can remember like going to 32 slice. That was huge. Then 64, right. You know.
120.
Yeah, now I don't even know what they are now, but it's,
I think, like, we have 128 here.
Yeah, right? I think. Yeah, imaging is, technology is, but you know, it doesn't replace seeing a patient,
no.
Touching a patient.
That's right.
Talking to the patient.
Absolutely.
And I mean, medical therapy. I'm an advocate for medical therapy. And I feel like we're still advancing in that field. At some point, you would think like, we're done, that's it. But every few years, I mean, you'll be astonished how new medications have literally like changing the spectrum of how you treat a lot of stuff, to the point that sometimes we discuss among each other, should we re-study these conditions? Because when we say, let's say this is a class one indication to give this medication, and then something new comes and overcomes that, I mean, we say, okay, I mean, how do we readdress this? I mean, were it not for the cost, there are a lot of new medications like for cardiomyopathies, for HCM, for amyloidosis, just name it, that literally have changed the spectrum of how we treat the cardiomyopathies.
Yeah, cardiac amyloid is that that has really changed a lot as far as treatment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's,
I mean, it used to be like, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it used to be a death sentence.
Literally, like, yeah, I'm sorry, just is what it is. I mean, right now it's not. And then, I mean, just before he left, he had a good series of people, Dr. Gonzalez, that he treated, and I mean, you see the success of the treatment. Like, it's very rewarding. You see how they do better.
I'm old enough that I remember when I remember we had Captopril, that just
that
won.
Was it.
Yeah, and how that started to change.
Yeah.
It changed more so, one is patients kind of quit showing up with this, what we call dropsy, this heart failure-like presentation with like cardiac renal, their kidney shutting down, just every, because, you know, they just weren't perfusing. And they started to show up more with arrhythmias, you know, because they stayed out of that heart failure condition. It was observable how things changed in that period of time.
So amyloidosis is one. And then there's another one, which is like literally like a game changer. It's called mavacamten. I don't know if you've heard about it. HCM, like hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathies. Yep. They came up, I mean, I knew about the medication that was under study in my fellowship, but literally about a couple of years, they approved it for the treatment of symptomatic patients with HCM that are not getting better with the standard metoprolol, diltiazem, verapamil treatments. It's a game changer, big time game changer. Like, the response is amazing. The way people feel, And to the point that almost now we're starting to think it's already changing the course of the disease by changing the hemodynamics of everything, by improving the cardiac output. Because ultimately, when cardiac output is not good, you're going to have fibrosis, you're going to have fluid overload, and this is like a vicious cycle of one condition eating itself. And then this medication is a big change in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, but not for everybody, though. There's a specific population for that, and like this is one of the things that I personally believe it's a rock star.
We started talking about advancements and changes. I had a patient who was a retired internist, and he was telling me that he started practice in the 1930s, right? He was almost close to 100 when he passed away. But he was my patient. He would tell me how like people would have heart attacks and they just put him in bed for a month.
That was the
instructions. Put bed rest 1 month.
Bed rest for heart attack and bed rest for congestive heart
failure.
For dilated cardiomyopathy. My mentor actually, Dr. Weber, they used to actually keep people bed rest and then do serial x-rays to see their heart shrinking. So they were resting the heart with the medications we are using right now, like the metoprolol and all this. But the idea was, is you rest the heart so it shrinks. And then by it shrinking, it will improve its hemodynamics, contractility, the stalling curve, all this. So how they used to do it.
Yeah,
they give them the leaves, the digoxin leaves.
Yeah.
To improve, this is how it was.
He started out in practice in San Diego. And the young doctors, just like here in town, Dr. Kettlecamp's dad was telling me once that like they would go do house calls for the older doctors so that, you know, these young doctors to help build a practice and earn extra money would make house calls on the older doctors' patients here in town. Well, in San Diego, you could pick up some extra money by being the hotel doctor. And then you go visit travelers in the hotel. And he said these people would have heart attacks and they give them IM, diuretic, Lasix. And come check on them every couple of days, you know, and amazingly they live and go on about it. But, will my great-grandchildren go, can you believe my great-grandpa gave people aspirin, you know, or a statin? Or there's a Woody Allen movie. I'm not a Woody Allen fan, so I can't tell you which movie it is. But there's one where he goes in the future and like the doctor stand there and looks in there and goes, you have to remember, he came from a time when they thought cholesterol was bad, you know. And the nurse is like, oh my gosh, you know, the poor man, you know. I mean, so things do change, that's why science. You know, people say, "Well, the science is settled." No, it's never settled. No. It is never settled. That's part of the scientific process.
I mean, it's not just the change; it's the speed of the change, right?
Right.
I think the innovation and the speed of innovation has really increased. If you look at the innovation in prior 30 years and last 10 years, we see, it's not even a comparison. So I think the speed with which the technology is we have not seen previously.
I mean, when I was in my third year fellowship, Dever and Clip were like, oh my gosh, we're excited. We're going to start Dever and Clip. That was 7 years ago. And now it's like, okay.
Now we have done 600.
Right? Well, and I think also there's no longer information asymmetry, right? Because the internet, you have access to that, you know, and you don't have these dominant. I mean, wasn't it Broomwald that wasn't in favor of ICDs, and he really delayed it like 10 years? Isn't that true?
That is to some degree.
Yeah.
One guy
could influence the entire. That doesn't happen anymore.
No,
you know, there's just too much information asymmetry. Right. Symmetry now,
right.
Where people
that's
have right. access to the all.
Yeah, if you prove something, that's it. People are going to ask why not.
Right.
So,
yeah, that's very interesting. So why'd you go into cardiology? Led you this way?
We'll started because if I start, I don't finish. So go ahead.
it's a great question. I mean, I loved electrophysiology. And one of the reasons I loved it because it's a lot of mental work. So it's like puzzle solving. So it combines intellectual work with procedures. So it gives you satisfaction of hands-on work and doing procedures at the same time, a lot of mental work. So I actually decided that I wanted to do electrophysiology even before I had done my residency. I actually was in Toronto doing research about EP that I did before. So I was pretty set on what I wanted to do
from the very beginning. Interesting. But
me, it was a love from the first sight. So.
You've always liked cardiology.
There is a story that initially I was more into orthopedics.
Really? So, that surprises me. So, I wouldn't have guessed that.
I used to be an athlete, like team athlete, varsity, stuff like that. So in my first year of medical school, like on the anatomy course, I used to be like superstar there, like knowing things, getting things right, like right away. And I was handy too. So everybody felt like, oh, he's going to go to orthopedics. And I thought the same, like people thought, and I thought the same way until like I started experiencing in my third year, the rotations. And I was like, no. There's no way I'm going to do that. And then I liked medicine, internal medicine. And then in my first rotation, in my fourth year, I did cardiology. And then that was it. That was it. Literally, that was it. Like, I could not believe why and how, but it was it. Like, I could tell, like, first rotation of the fourth year, I was like, cardiology. I didn't know exactly which branch, but that was it. So from there on, it was only about cardiology. And surprisingly, I went back one day to read my physiology book, Guyton. And Guyton has like, what, 20 plus chapters, right? So
at least.
And I used to read a lot. Like I used to read books from like front to end. Which chapter or which topic in that book has the most highlighted, and this is first year medical school, physiology. Which chapter had the most highlight in it, most scratching on it, most not on it? Cardiology. So something was there. Okay, I didn't know it, but it literally, like, it was there. And that's why I call it love from the first sight. I mean, I would have not done something different.
I was a big, growing up, big Sherlock Holmes fan. Loved to read Arthur Conan Doyle. So I always liked the kind of trying to figure out what the mystery aspect of it. And so that's internal medicine.
Never
wanted to do anything different. Never really even thought about it.
You can sometimes explain it. It's that thing. That's it. You have that passion for it, and then keeps going. And then the more I did it, the more I loved it. And I keep telling everybody, I mean, were it not for that passion in this specialty, we would have dropped a long time ago. It's exhausting. So,
yeah.
That burden that carries with it, the stress, I mean, unless you have a thing to it, you won't last.
If you don't like to help people, you will not survive in this job. Right. You know,
and you have to really like what you're doing.
Yeah, you do. So. And I always say that people say, oh, how long are you going to work? When are you going to retire? And I'm like, when I get up one morning and it feels like a job, then that'll be my last day.
That is correct.
Other than that, I'll still come.
That's absolutely right.
It's not a job yet.
Yeah.
No, it's a good thing.
I'm going to make this comment just to see if my orthopedic friends, Dr. Schweitzer, is listening, but you're too smart for orthopedics. So if he sends me a nasty text, I'll know he actually listens to my podcast. So, well, Dr. Eldrazi, Dr. Fareed, thank you for joining me once again. This is Dr. Fayed Eldrazi and Tala Fareed, cardiologist with St. Luke's Heart Care Clinic. To learn more about heart care services, visit unipoint.org/crheart. Thank you for listening to Live Well Talk On. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe. And if you want to spread the word, please give us a 5-star review and tell your family, friends, neighbors, strangers about our podcast. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, or wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, be well.